On November 9th through the 11th, the Federal Society hosted the 2023 National Lawyers Convention in Washington, D.C. This year's theme was Originalism on the Ground, and it featured many excellent speeches, debates, and discussion panels covering a wide range of important legal and policy issues. This recording comes from that event, and we hope you enjoy it.
Now on to our panel, and we do have an all-star group. Today, our moderator, Judge Michael Park, was appointed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in May of 2019. He earned his undergraduate degree, magna cum laude, from Princeton University, his JD from the Yale Law School, where he served as the managing editor of the Yale Law Journal. After graduation from law school, Judge Park served as a law clerk to then-Judge Sam Alito on the Third Circuit, for whom he also clerked on the Supreme Court during the 2008 term. Judge Park also served as an attorney advisor in the U.S. Department of Justice, also Office of Legal Counsel, and was a partner in the New York office of the Deckert Law Firm, and later joined as a named partner of the law firm of Consovoy, McCarthy, and Park. During this time, he also served as an adjunct professor at the Antonin Scalia School of Law at George Mason University. With that, I will turn it over to Judge Park as our moderator. And thank you again for serving today.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Brian, for the kind introduction, and thanks for everyone for being here. Welcome to our discussion on originalism in the Communications Act of 1934, the bounds of the FCC's regulatory authority in the modern era. Just a quick description of what we're going to discuss. The U.S. Senate recently confirmed the third Democratic FCC Senate commissioner, putting the agency at full force for the first time since January 2021. This panel will focus on the FCC's likely agenda as we look to 2024, and we'll explore the bounds of the Communications Act of 1934, as updated by the Telecommunications Act of 1996, when applied to modern technology, areas for possible legislative reform, and how the existing regulatory authority from Congress impacts the Commission's initiatives in the year ahead. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel. First, we have FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr to my left. Commissioner Carr is the senior Republican on the FCC, and he previously served as the agency's general counsel. Commissioner Carr was nominated to the FCC by President Trump and was confirmed unanimously by the Senate. He's been described as the FCC's 5G crusader. Commissioner Carr has led the FCC's work to modernize its infrastructure rules and to accelerate the build-out of high-speed networks. His reforms have cut billions of dollars in red tape, enabled the private sector to construct high-speed networks across the country, and extended America's global leadership in 5G. Before joining the agency as a staffer back in 2012, Commissioner Carr worked at Wiley Ryan in the firm's appellate litigation and telecommunications practices, and before that, he clerked on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit for Judge Dennis Shedd. He attended Georgetown University and earned his JD magna cum laude from the Catholic University of America's Columbus School of Law. To his left is Commissioner Nathan Symington. Commissioner Symington was nominated to the FCC by President Trump and was confirmed by the Senate in 2020. Before joining the FCC, Commissioner Symington served as the senior advisor at the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, the NTIA, where he worked on many aspects of telecommunications policy, including spectrum allocation and planning, broadband access, and the U.S. government's role in the internet. Before joining the FCC, Commissioner Symington was senior counsel to Brightstar Corporation, an international mobile device services company, where he led and negotiated telecommunications equipment and services deals with providers in over 20 countries. Before joining Brightstar, he worked in private practice. Commissioner Symington is a graduate of Michigan Law School and also holds degrees from the University of Rochester and Lawrence University. To his left is Mr. Jordan Adelstein, former commissioner of the FCC. Mr. Adelstein is president and CEO of WIA, the Wireless Infrastructure Association, which represents over 200 companies building telecommunication facilities across the world. Mr. Adelstein served as the FCC commissioner from 2002 to 2009, for which he was twice nominated by President George W. Bush and confirmed unanimously by the Senate. At the FCC, he achieved bipartisan progress on issues like broadband expansion, widening access to the internet, and media diversity. In 2009, Commissioner Adelstein was nominated by President Obama to serve as the administrator of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Utilities Service, where he oversaw a $6 billion portfolio of rural, electric, water, and telecommunications infrastructure loans. Previously, Commissioner Adelstein held a number of legislative staff positions over 15 years in the U.S. Senate, culminating as a senior policy advisor to the Senate Majority Leader. Commissioner Adelstein received an MA in History and a BA in Political Science from Stanford and attended the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. And last but not least, former FCC Commissioner Mignon Clyburn is principal of MLC Strategies. Commissioner Clyburn spent nearly 9 years at the FCC, affirming her commitment to closing persistent digital and opportunity divides that challenge rural, native, and low-wealth communities. Commissioner Clyburn served as commissioner of the FCC from 2009 to 2018 and as acting FCC chairwoman from May to November of 2013. As an FCC commissioner, she pushed for the modernization of the FCC's Lifeline program, which assists low-income consumers in defraying the costs of voice and broadband service. She championed diversity and media ownership, initiated inmate telephone calling services reforms, brokered a technical solution that eliminated long-standing bottlenecks that prevented small and rural telecommunications carriers, from expanding their network services nationwide. She emphasized diversity and inclusion in the STEM fields, and she fought to preserve a free and open internet. Commissioner Clyburn's government service began with her election to the South Carolina Public Service Commission in 1998, where she served for 11 years. Before that, Commissioner Clyburn worked in a variety of media and telecommunications positions for over 14 years as publisher and general manager of the Coastal Times, a family-founded Charleston-based weekly newspaper focusing on issues affecting the African-American community. It's my pleasure to then introduce all of you. Thank you for joining us today. And we'll begin in terms of format with opening statements from each of the panelists, followed by a discussion. And we'll conclude with a Q&A, taking questions from members of the audience. So with that, we'll hear from Commissioner Carr.
Thank you so much, Judge. Great to have you on the bench. And it's great to be with all of you here today. I guess for maybe an opening, I'll ask for a show of hands of how many people remember the great net neutrality repeal of 2017. We got a couple of veterans here. Of those people that remember, did you survive? Show of hands if you survived the great net neutrality repeal. I want to talk really briefly about sort of two FCC proceedings and then sort of explain to you why they aren't isolated pinpricks and why what you're seeing at the FCC in those instances is something that you're seeing reflected more broadly across the administrative state right now. The first is what I call Title II, what has been popularly branded as net neutrality. So as you remember, for the very first time ever, the last 2 years of President Obama's administration, the FCC reclassified the internet from a Title I information service, a regulated service, but lightly regulated, to a Title II regulated service. Title II was the sort of utility style, heavy-handed regulations that were first invented to rein in the Ma Bell telephone monopoly, a point in time of sort of New Deal era legislation where it was really hard to distinguish between government and private sector. The FCC did that for 2 years. Then when the administration changed over, the Trump administration, I was a commissioner and we reversed that 2-year experiment. And if you remember when we did that, the predictions, if you remember, were quite astonishing. Senator Bernie Sanders had said that this is the end of the internet as we know it. If this passes, the internet in the free exchange of information we've come to know will cease to exist. CNN ran a banner headline that said, end of the internet as we know it. I got a message, Commissioner Clyburn likes this story. I got a message from a high school ex-girlfriend at the time, and she said that repealing net neutrality, I was about to make the second biggest mistake of my life. I can assure you that neither breaking up with her nor repealing Title II was a mistake.
He says in front of you right now.
Right. And, you know, but what we were told was speeds would slow down. You'd get the internet one word at a time. And what has happened since that 2017 repeal of Title II? Internet speeds in the U.S. are up sixfold. Millions of Americans have been brought across the digital divide because of private sector build-out. And COVID-19 was the ultimate stress test of global telecom policy. In Europe, they were very worried that their continents networks were going to break under the sudden strain of internet traffic that surged as people started working from home and schooling their kids remotely. We didn't have that worry here because we had heavy investment in our networks. And so just recently, as the judge indicated, we're back to 3-2 at the FCC. For the first time, Commissioner Simonton and I are in the minority. We were 2-2 for a while. 2-2 is my second best thing compared to being in the majority. It was a pretty good run, but now we're in the minority. The very first thing the FCC does is now propose to bring back that Title II regulatory regime, which I think is going to be a mistake. Following right on the heels of that, the FCC has launched what is called a digital equity proceeding, and we're actually going to vote on a final order next Wednesday. President Biden had the Commerce Department weigh in at the FCC and encourage us to take a very strident interpretation of a one-page section of the 1,000-plus page infrastructure law that was passed in 2021. It was a provision called digital discrimination that said the FCC should, you know, work to identify or eliminate discrimination that takes place in the broadband markets. The FCC has taken this one-page law and read it as giving us effectively unbounded authority over every single type of internet service and infrastructure in the country. If you just read through the list of the things that the FCC is saying, this one-page bill, which is not quite prophylactic, but it's mostly hortatory, mostly forward-looking, what we're doing there is we're exercising control over where infrastructure can be built, how much profit an ISP can realize, the prices that can be charged, everything from down to the length of time that an installation should take, and we're gonna be second-guessing all of those decisions, and if we reach the decision that it's somehow resulting in a harm to equity, then you're potentially liable for unlimited fines from the FCC. And so I think you're seeing, you know, whether it's Title II, whether it's digital equity, or again, some of the actions you see at other agencies, what's going on? And this is where I sort of started, which is to say, these aren't sort of individual pieces of glass, there's a mosaic going on. And what's happening right now with the administrative state, in my view, is that you've got this very progressive wing of the Democrat Party, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, that has real outside influence when it comes to the administrative agencies right now in this administration. And we aren't having a reasoned debate right now within the agencies about, you know, okay, a debate between the 40s, this person's a Democrat, you know, they have their perspective, elections have consequences, I get it. We're not having sort of the type of reasoned debate that you would expect in a divided government right now. What's happening is that wing of the Democrat Party is using the administrative state to really fundamentally alter the relationship between the government and the private sector. And it really goes back to this whole sort of Title II, New Deal era mindset that we haven't really had a debate about in this country, let alone from an electoral perspective, settled on fundamentally changing our relationship between the government and the private sector. But it's happening right now in the administrative agencies. The good news, I'll end with this, is where the Supreme Court is in terms of looking at some of the excesses of administrative agencies. West Virginia versus EPA effectively took what had been a dissent from the FCC's prior Title II decision by Judge Kavanaugh in the DC Circuit and is approximately making it the majority opinion at the Supreme Court. So while we're engaging in a lot of these regulatory excesses right now with the FCC and other agencies, I'm very confident that these are going to be reined back in eventually by the Supreme Court, because after all, we have not been delegated the authority to make these types of sweeping decisions. So with that, I'll end my filibuster and pass it on.
Thank you, Commissioner Simonton.
Thanks very much. I'm very pleased to be here and to join my esteemed colleagues here on the panel. So, on the subject of regulation, media regulation is very much in the news. There's a maelstrom of congressional and lobbying activity swirling around the question of so-called virtual MVPDs, that is, multi-channel video programming distributors like cable and satellite TV, and whether the commission ought to extend its authority to regulate retransmission consent negotiations, that is, the money that gets passed along for retransmitting broadcast content, over online linear video providers. I'm going to preview my own position on this one. I have no idea. There's no timely record before me. No member of the commission can make a decision responsibly without record support. And so it shouldn't surprise anyone that my position is that a record refresh is warranted. It hasn't changed in the previous 2 years that I've been thinking about this VMVPD docket. I don't know whether it's possible to extend commission authority over VMVPDs. nor do I know whether it's the appropriate moment to do so as a matter of policy. A record refresh, a public notice inviting new comments on a decade-old proceeding, would merely arm the commission with the facts and the law. And I'll soon be sending a reply to a congressional inquiry from a couple of weeks ago saying the same thing, albeit at greater length. So one point I'm going to make in this letter is one that I'd like to discuss here today. Namely, we should reset our expectations, because without congressional action, I'm not sure that there is such a thing as commission regulation of the media marketplace in the future. And maybe that's a good thing, but we should be clear that that's a decision that we're taking consciously and not by default. I've never given a panegyric on contemporary commission wisdom in media regulation, goodness knows. I'm certainly not going to do so here. It may wind up being a good thing to let commission authority over the video marketplace lapse. We may want to engage in a greater deregulatory trend to ensure that there isn't a two-tier system where facilities-based legacy broadcasters are penalized for doing that and over-the-top providers are allowed to exploit a regulatory middle. So, peering into my crystal ball, however, I feel that's not on what's on tap for the upcoming quadrennial review. Somehow I imagine we'll discover or invent new and creative ways to extend commission authority over even the smallest shade tree broadcasting outfits, rendering profitable operation in small DMAs fully impossible and paving the way towards what we all know is the goal of some groups in society and what they've said explicitly, government takeover of broadcast. So I guess this is where my discussion of jurisdiction starts to rhyme a little bit with what Commissioner Carr has been saying about government takeover of the internet. At a certain point, if broadcast becomes economically unviable, yet we want to continue regulating it, that's the immediate future of broadcast media, having been rendered artificially uncompetitive with over-the-top. Depending on who you ask, 2/3 to 4/5 of domestic internet traffic goes to streaming video. And it should not surprise anyone to learn that whenever a new fiber trunk is installed in a rural area, most of the excess capacity is immediately soaked up by streaming video upscaling. Looking at it through this lens, high-cost build-out subsidies, in effect, if not in intent, and I think it would have been pretty hard to sell this to the public in these terms, but it looks like a concerted effort to take and replace the legacy media transmission mode of over-the-air terrestrial broadcast, or even of installed cable and satellite systems, with a government-subsidized Netflix pipe. Not to pick on Netflix in particular, but there's no doubt that a lot of this content is Netflix content. Of course, it could be any streaming provider. So when the future of media is fully streaming, and the Commission, together with Congress, is making every effort to deliver on that vision, apparently, what's the statutory predicate of our authority? And here we turn back again to the question of regulation of over-the-top content. If we look at the landmark decisions in terms of the FCC's jurisdiction over broadcast and over speech in broadcast, we're looking at Red Lion and Pacifica, which stood for the proposition that the Commission could pin back the ears of broadcasters, at least somewhat, as to protected speech because of the literal physical transmission modality of broadcast signals. That is, because spectrum is scarce and managed by the FCC, and because broadcast signals involuntarily penetrate the home, and because they're rivalrous with one another. Potentially, broadcast occupies a unique space in comparison to other media of protected speech. So we've all lived our lives in a world where it's been a well-settled principle that because broadcasters do these things, they don't have the full speech protections for protected speech that we would have in other media that are not so restricted, such as print. So whether those decisions remain good law in the current media marketplace and whether broadcasters ought to be treated in a fashion harmonized with other players, not going to show my own biases here, may be fully mooted over the next decade anyway, because as broadcast falls into secular decline, aided lately by the vigorous efforts of the Commission, Commission authority over broadcast media and how it interacts with the First Amendment increasingly looks like a dead letter. Who cares whether the First Amendment protects a speech against commission interference when there are simply no more licensed broadcasters for whom it would be an issue? Okay, so what about non-broadcast programming carried on MVPDs? We don't license them. We can't reach them as to content, and currently there's no statutory or court predicate for getting to that point. What about other bases of commission authority over, say, cable systems? The 92 Cable Act gave the Commission authority explicitly, and in general, the Commission relies on a facilities basis as the predicate of most of its authority over wireline system. So we still have cable systems and direct broadcast satellite in the regs because of those physical facilities that are involved. Great, except the cable systems are shedding millions of subscribers per year. As the American consumer chooses, and I use that word advisedly considering the subsidy and regulatory arbitrage aspects that I've highlighted, but nonetheless chooses to get content on over-the-top channels. And of course, we've all seen how well the satellite guys are doing lately. So while traditional MVPDs seem to have a little room left to run, it seems that the writing may start to be on the wall for them as well. And indeed, if you look at many cable operators who have both a video business and an ISP business, they'll often tell you that it's the ISP business where they really see their runway. The future, whether consumers have asked for it or not, or whether it's simply emerged as a confluence of regulatory thumbs on the scale that no one really planned or intended, or whether there was, you know, or whether there were people arranging this for their benefit or engaging in opportunistic lobbying, the point is, the future is over the top, and the Commission cannot circumvent First Amendment restrictions on the basis of the physical characteristics of the medium, nor does it have a facilities basis as traditionally understood, undergirding its authority to regulate. Therefore, edge providers who are further subject, shielded by Section 230 protections are in a very strong position to say that there's just no such thing as content regulation and over the top. That may be how we expect it to wind out. From all the complaints that I hear from both sides of the aisle, I'm not sure that's a decision that anyone is comfortable with. If it's going to become the new normal, then we'd better start building out private ways to live with it. But in any case, our expectation that there's going to be speech regulation is just going to become falsified very quickly. Our anticipation of a regulated media environment is just not going to prevail. So it would appear the way things are trending that nothing will happen unless Congress takes this issue up with this degree of clarity, recognizing that the disparity in physical medium between watching a Bonanza rerun over the air and watching it on demand make the regulatory environment completely different for those two situations. So Congress has got to consider whether we want to consciously walk into this situation or whether we're sleepwalking into it. They have to consider what their constituents are going to expect from them. They're going to have to ask the question, what does it mean for someone who spent 60, 70 years of their life growing up in a regulated media environment to suddenly be confronted with totally unregulated media at this point in our lives? What about interference? We hear so much about Russian interference in the elections or some other country's interference in the elections, all this kind of thing. What exactly are we supposed to do about it in an atmosphere of over the top where nothing, there's no political file, nothing whatsoever is stopping anyone from buying anything on any show? So I want to make sure that I'm not calling for anything in particular so much as awareness of the situation and for us to appreciate the distinction between where we've been until now and where we're going to be now and going forward. Now, I guess if I am going to make a call for action or a recommendation, it would be that the best thing the Commission can do right now in the media marketplace is just to get out of the business of broadcast regulation. I'm not saying that we need to turn it down to two guys and a dog. I'd settle for three. But there's really an angle to which we have to ask the question, what social good exactly is being served by media regulation that still pretends it's 1972 and that the big three rule the air? I think there's none. I think at this point we should be asking instead, what are we trying to preserve as far as localism and journalism, as far as a profitable, sustainable business model of whatever size in small and medium-sized communities in terms of real local relevance to advertising and not just feeding it into gigantic national social media campaigns. In terms, I might add, of the maintenance of the emergency alerting systems that have always been funded, not just in dollars and cents, but in terms of capacity and personnel and resilience by broadcasters. So there are a number of social goods that I think could be preserved just fine if we eliminated the regulatory arbitrage here and gave broadcasters a fair shake. So that's something the Commission could do right away without waiting for congressional action. But otherwise, the ball is in Congress's court. The inflexible and mechanical application of legacy commission rules is just going to continue to kill the broadcast sector while leaving the entire question of speech regulation off the field. In other words, we're going to stick by the environment of the 70s to say that we need to regulate broadcast speech and hug it to death, and that at the same time we've got no reason to reach into anything else. That's just pure path dependence, folks. There's no rhyme nor reason to a policy approach like that. If Congress intends that the Commission should in fact regulate media in the future, which I'm not calling for, I just want to point out without intervention it simply will not. And people will have to think hard about finding a predicate that is, in fact, not violative of the First Amendment. Thanks very much. Looking forward to a lively discussion.
Thank you. Commissioner Adelstein.
Well, thank you, Judge Park, and thanks for inviting me here today. I really appreciate it. It's nice to be on a panel with sitting commissioners. We're the has-been commissioners, and the real ones are over there. We rarely get elevated to that level, but interestingly, these are Republican appointees, Democratic appointees on this side, so this room will be happy that the ones in power are sitting
The Capitol also flows that way compared to this side.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Well, that could change. I think I'm going to focus more, since I'm not in the broadcast world now, Commissioner Symington, on Commissioner Carr's comments, and really focus today particularly on some of the legal issues surrounding net neutrality and to a lesser extent, the digital equity ruling. Net neutrality is something I've been involved in since the very outset of it in, 2003, back on the commission when we first looked into this. And it's really an article of faith on both sides, on the Democratic side and Republican side. First, as you pointed out, is it adopted under Obama by Wheeler, repealed under Trump with Ajit, and now about to be or proposed to be reinstated in almost the same form by Chairwoman Rosenworcel now that she's gained the majority. So previous court rulings, as you pointed out, forced the FCC to go into a Title II if they wanted to apply net neutrality, and that means that they're treated, as you said, as common carriers, and things have to be just and reasonable. So it's very heavy-handed regulation. So the question, the basic tenets of net neutrality, which we started with back, and there was bipartisan agreement on in the early days, were no blocking, no throttling, and no paid prioritization, are largely complied with by ISPs. So, going back when it was pushed in the early 2000s by large cloud providers like Google, as the white knight. In those days, they were beloved and seen as sort of fighting for the good of the internet to preserve free carriage, essentially at the expense of ISPs. And what we've seen since then, is that it's inhibited carriers from monetizing their network investments in infrastructure, and it's now so entrenched in practice that the new rule won't change the status quo that gives cloud providers a free ride, and the cloud providers like Meta, Netflix, Google have captured the lion's share of the revenue and certainly the profits from the growth of the internet. And you look at the stock of some of the major carriers, it's exactly where it was in the mid-90s, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. Some, and you'd think if you look back in the mid-90s and you say, all right, everybody's gonna own one or two of these devices, everybody's gonna use them, nobody's gonna live without them. There'll be more than one per person in the country. Probably the major wireless carriers are gonna be doing pretty well, right, in 20 years from now? Well, their stock is flat or down in that period. It's pretty remarkable. But the stock of these companies that didn't exist at that time when they first began are in the trillions. So, the FCC is gonna finalize the new rules probably in early to mid-year 2024, leading to another round of litigation. And that's what might be of interest to discuss today to this crowd, is how the Supreme Court's major questions doctrine will apply with a 2 to 3 year legal saga ahead. Now, coming from my perspective, the way that the major questions doctrine is being applied strikes me as judicial activism, attractive to rein in the administrative state as a counter to Chevron. So, the question is whether the courts or the expert agencies interpret congressional intent and statute when it's unclear. Now, I served on the Senate staff for 15 years, as you pointed out, and was involved in, interpreting, or basically writing the law. The staff had a huge role in writing these laws, and when I was in the majority leader or minority leader's office, I was basically making the sausage. And it was very hard then to get Congress to get specific. You think it was hard in the 90s, it's a lot harder now. So it's very difficult for Congress to get specific, which is why they delegate to agencies and give them basic direction and allow the agencies to delegate, they delegate to agencies how to interpret these statutes. And so the question here for me is, somebody's looked at the Constitution and served in two of the three branches, should the courts or agencies interpret the statute fundamentally? And I say the expert agencies, not the courts. And look at the way the Constitution is structured. Article 1 is Congress, Article 2 the executive agencies, Article 3 is the courts, all due respect to Judge Park. The idea is that law is obviously paramount, and the executive agencies are the ones to interpret and execute the laws, and the courts are to hold them accountable to ensure that they do it in an honest way. Now, most issues at the FCC are bipartisan, and it truly performed its role effectively. I think that witness to that is the way that these two outstanding commissioners handled the 2-2 situation, as you pointed out, up until just very recently when the third commissioner on the Democratic side was approved. The FCC got a lot done, and most of what we do is bipartisan. But some things get politicized. As I pointed out, you know, net neutrality is probably the premier example of that. So the question for those of us who support Chevron deference for agencies is the FCC handing the Supreme Court a case that is ripe to overturn it? What's the justification for flip-flopping on policy every time the administration changes party hands? Is it truly an expert agency if it keeps changing? Well, to me, if it's going to change every time there's a change in control of the administration, there has to be evidence of a change in material circumstances to justify the shift in policy. Here, there's no evidence of a problem, as you pointed out. The internet is still alive and well. Hence, it's more ripe for getting overturned and setting what I think is a bad precedent. Now, it gets particularly interesting in this case because the irony is that Justice Thomas' opinion in the Brand X case cited Chevron to allow the FCC to decide whether to classify under Title I or Title II to deregulate certain ISPs. So that decision, he said, oh, Chevron, this is deregulatory, this is great, let's let Chevron rule. Now the decision has been used to impose, you know, a strong regulatory regime. Justice Thomas is questioning his own decision. See, now we're looking at flip-flopping by both the FCC and the Supreme Court. Both sides appear to me to be outcome-driven, which is worse, for a federal agency to be outcome-driven or the courts? I would argue the courts. We expect the courts to be neutral arbiters. You expect at least some changes from administration to administration, and certainly looking at the changes in circumstances if they occur, the agency should be in a position to do that, and the courts should be a neutral arbiter. So if there's a precedent here, why is it getting overturned? Well, is it a major questions issue? Or is that, you know, an excuse? Could that be an excuse by the courts for deregulation? How can the Supreme Court flip using this doctrine from the Brand X decision, which is so recent and so direct to the point? We expect consistent principled decisions from the Supreme Court, but the new version of the major questions doctrine appears outcome-driven, and now they've got this case that could be handed where the agency is flip-flopping without an evidentiary basis. So you're seeing both agencies and the Supreme Court increasingly politicized, which I think undermines confidence in both as independent arbiters of the law. On the substance of the policy, in our industry, there's a serious concern with how the imposition of Title II impacts 5G in particular, which wireless carriers are clearly having trouble monetizing, as I've discussed. And we've discussed this, you know, there's an issue that the draft, like the previous Wheeler rule, subjects mobile to the same rules as wireline. But among the biggest upsides to 5G is its ability to facilitate private networks and slicing, which are by nature discriminatory. People here probably don't know about network slicing unless you're deep into the weeds on this telecom law, but essentially under 5G is the first technology where carriers can take a piece of its spectrum and a piece of its network, basically slice it off and allow a business to have a private little network of its own, which, you know, seems to be in some ways violative of the idea of net neutrality, but at the same time there's an exemption for specialized services in the draft, but it's vague, so it's difficult for carriers to know if they're going to be able to engage in innovative solutions without further clarification from the FCC. So it could have a chilling effect on already depressed 5G capex. But, you know, to sort of conclude on the major questions doctrine, I'd ask, you know, when I think about that more broadly, why are we distinguishing major and minor issues? Statutory construction should be the same either way. Congress writes major and minor statutes with all kinds of vagaries in them that agencies have to distinguish. And I understand why the major questions doctrine says, well, if it's big, Congress wouldn't have really delegated it without thinking about it, but without having been more explicit about it. But I think the same applies to minor issues. So really, this seems like a power grab by the courts, judicial aggrandizement to say we're going to take over administrative law on the biggest issues in the country because Congress shouldn't be able to delegate on major issues, but they should be able to delegate on minor issues. But, you know, the FCC may be inviting an egregious example of overruling a precedent to apply this newfound major questions doctrine. So interesting kind of situation that we're in from a legal perspective I wanted to talk about. And just to wrap up on the aggressive interpretation of the digital equity rules, I would agree, you know, applying them far beyond, I think, what Congress intended doesn't make a lot of sense. For example, you know, I'm at DigitalBridge now, and we invest in a lot of infrastructure, and we essentially follow where our customers want us to go. So if a carrier says, I want a cell tower here, or I want some fiber over there, we'll provide it. But then we're subject to being questioned as to whether we're providing digital equity when we're simply following our customers as to where they want us to place infrastructure. So applying it to infrastructure seems a step too far, and I think beyond what Congress intended, which again is, I think, going to invite certainly some scrutiny in the courts, but I'd rather see that addressed by the FCC in advance. And I hope that with the good work of these commissioners sitting here and the chair and the other commissioners, that can get addressed before they adopt it on November 15th, but I'm not overly confident.
Unlikely.
I'm not overly confident.
Magic 8-Ball says, not going to happen.
You heard it here first. Whoops, I guess that's not going to happen. Well, pray on. Well, thank you very much for the time. I'll wrap it there.
Thank you. Commissioner Clyburn.
Thank you, Judge Park. It's a pleasure being here. Thank you, Brian Tremont, for the invitation. Either you'll get blamed or uplifted. And also, please allow this. I'm from South Carolina, and Steve Matthews is here from my old high school, so allow me to say hello in the back from the gentleman who just had a big smile back there. It's good to be here. 9 years ago in Hillary Schaub's Brookings Institute commentary commending the Act's 80th anniversary, she described the Communications Act of 1934 as being considered at the time, and I quote, a minor piece of legislation bundled with the New Deal. And if RadioWorld.com is right, the standard government printed text version of the 34 Act numbered some 45 pages with 6 titles. Fast forward 89 years, and subject to check, as you lawyers like to say, nearly 300 pages later, you have challenged us this afternoon with an intriguing theme, originalism, I'm cold, so if you hear things, and the Communications Act of 1934. Clearly, this is no longer considered a minor piece of legislation. I find it fascinating, so I'm the one you'll throw darts at today, but I'll just go ahead and accept them, so get ready. I find it fascinating to hear scholars, academicians, jurists, and likely more than a couple of you in this room, adhere to the concept that all statements in the United States Constitution should be interpreted strictly according to how it would have been understood or intended at the time of its adoption in 1787. Now, if I am interpreting this position correctly, and were to apply that same standard or concept to the Communications Act of 1934, I would not only have to wrestle with its first major overhaul in 62 years in the form of the 96 Act, but the predecessor laws of 1906, 1910, 1912, and 1927 each, responding to a changing landscape to regulate safety, frequencies, licensing, and operating guidelines. In the 1934 Act, as you know, the FCC was created to manage administrative and broadcast issues of the day, as well as to regulate interstate and foreign communications, among many other responsibilities. And if I may to continue with my analogy, the 27 amendments enacted between 1791 and 1992 reflect changing societal values not contemplated nor enacted in 1787. The point for me here is that with every technological advance, every creative development, my new entrance, every policy shift, there has been a corresponding reinterpretation, redefining, statutory overlay, or rewriting of laws regulating or not companies in this space. Granted, 62 years is a very long time given the shifts that were occurring or have been occurring in the marketplace. And the 96 Act was offered as an answer to our struggle to keep pace with an evolving, technologically advancing landscape. The complexity and difference between policy, competitive, and technological issues today, policy issues from 1934, and yes, even 1996, seem dizzying to me. But what I suspect near universal agreement on is that we have reached another inflection point where there is friction on how much or how little we do to establish new policy to address the evolving issues at hand. As a baseline, I suggest, as nirvana, is the creation of policy where all stakeholders articulate exactly what the problem is and where all stakeholders are in agreement. But nirvana is a word rarely used, making it difficult to set a successful agenda around an issue with consensus. But the primary objective, in my humble opinion, should always be to prevent any one party from framing an issue in the form of the resolution or outcome they would like to see, not what the times call for. As an easy example, though I know the FCC is not in the pricing or price regulation business, would be if one party proclaims that the issue should be that we should be charged less, when the actual issue in question should be, what is the appropriate pricing tool? Fully understanding the issue, consequences, and each option before us, and their likely policy outcome is the most intense, informative, reflective, and time-consuming exercise. Listening to parties' positions and arguments, sifting through subject matter interests with public interest groups, special interest groups, interested parties, and often legislators' comments and concerns. That's a complex and dynamic process. All of this, of course, precedes the adoption and implementation, then monitoring and assessment of what is ultimately decided. Congressional legislation, executive orders, judicial interpretation, the agency decision being upheld again or struck down, and whatever public policy modification, all of these influences, decisions, or shift triggers, and you have, let's just call it, a very fluid, dynamic set of challenges that will enable us to do good or challenge us to do better. And then, of course, are the decision makers on my right. A total of five of them, finally, who no doubt, just like I did before the summer of 2018, where I took my leave, have been asked and challenged more than once when it comes to policy making. Should the goal be to prevent or correct potential market failures or harms before they occur, or rather to rely on enforcement or remedies after a harm violation has occurred? I am acutely aware that ex-ante regulation is aggressively proactive, while ex-post regulation is not. And while one attempts to anticipate, address, or mitigate what could be irreversible or costly harms, as opposed to responding after problems materialize, if you ask me, my answer when challenged with that question would not surprise you. It depends. It depends on the type of action, market segment, entry barriers, systemic risk, and other factors made on a case-by-case basis depending on the facts in play at the time. And that is why I sometimes arm wrestle with my colleagues, because I understand when it comes to the net neutrality re-debate, whichever re, how many times we are re-ing.
According to Blair Levin, it's seven.
You know, I come from the posture that won't surprise you, is that we make decisions and policies and rules and laws, not based on the best of times when everything is swimming, but on those times when the most vulnerable have something to be concerned about, or no, we are concerned about them and their outcomes. But what is known and measurable with all of this dynamic, the state of our economy, our priorities and stated needs, we're influenced by international and domestic trends, political and legal dynamics, and the public expectations. That's the number one priority and the number one influencers, particularly at the community level. There, and primarily there, will influence and determine where the agency leans, but not necessarily, not always where the agency lands when it comes to advanced services and the collective successes or failures of the majority of the five will be measured always by whichever party, whichever influencers have the ears over the congressional or judicial branches. So today it's net neutrality. As we said, I've lost count.
And tomorrow it will be neutrality again.
Okay, yeah. Well, today in the global today, we have net neutrality. As was mentioned, the prevention of digital discrimination, rules to be debated, spectral policy, including the impact of the lack of auction authority, that allocation of spectrum efficient and fairly among commercial providers, federal agencies, public safety entities, and consumers, while considering all of those technical and economic aspects of spectral management, such as interference sharing and pricing, broadband deployment, rules, data and mapping, the harmonization of various programs that have been layered, to address the needs particularly at the pandemic and this case, what survives and what does not? Robocalls, the emergency alert systems, rights of way fees, USF, for me and its principles and its future, including, like I said, those legal challenges. And yes, I am going to mention it, the contribution factor. So we're at a very interesting time, and I know everyone says this, but it is particularly interesting because we are wrestling, with a number of things. You've got the calls for access to affordable, reliable, and high-quality digital infrastructure, mobile networks, again, cloud computing, e-government, that can enable communities to access information, education, healthcare, entertainment, and social services, as well as full participation in civic and economic activities. You've got calls for inclusion and equity in the design, development, and use of technologies, especially from marginalized and vulnerable groups, older adults, which I have become. People with disabilities, those who are from low-income and rural communities, they face barriers accessing benefiting from the technology that many of us in this room take for granted. Again, you've got calls for empowerment and engagement of the communities in shaping these technological landscape, particularly as the money is flowing to state and local governments. There's a need for resilience and the adaptation of rapid and complex changes that technologies bring to social, economic, and environmental aspects of the communities. Technologies creating new challenges, opportunities, and yes, risk in these communities. The tackling and the addressing of the digital divide, cyber attacks, misinformation, automation, displacement, or environmental impacts. Communities are crying for the capacity to cope and to respond to these challenges, as well as leveraging the opportunities that these technologies and the times offer us. And then there's AI and its implications, particularly those who feel that there are vulnerabilities and unevenness and inequities abound. So I end as I begin. and I often rely on history being the daughter of a former history teacher and librarian. That I hear you speak about the shifts, the ebbs and flows, as if it were something new or unpredictable. It is not. You have laws, decisions that in some ways seem static, but you have interpreters through policymakers and other interested parties that will demand of us that constant reinterpretation and reapplication of what seemingly is static and finite to address the interests and the challenges of today. So to me, while I know there are tensions and disappointments among all of us depending on what decision we do or do not make, none of this is surprising. All of this is quite understandable because the communities that we serve and the people who are on the wrong side of some of these issues will demand that we interpret every law and every rule in a way that will improve their communities. That is a constant, that is evolving, and all of that is to be expected. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thanks to all of you for your thoughtful and thought-provoking statements. Let me open up the discussion by just giving all of you a chance to respond to anything that you heard from each other that you want to react to, respond to, expand on.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I'll pick up a little bit on my good friend's comments on the major questions doctrine. I have some differences of opinion there. I'll say, I think, fundamentally, I think in my view, the major questions doctrine operates in a very neutral way, that it is not an expression of sort of substantive preferences or will. So if Congress passes a law that is regulatory in nature and an agency uses it to deregulate, you can run afoul of the major questions doctrine. Similarly, if they tell us to deregulate and you regulate the opposite, you get the same outcome. But I also want to step back in terms of the separation of powers and almost the constitutional question and think about it from a policy perspective. And you ask, why would it make sense that there be a major questions doctrine, but yet there'll be sort of lesser questions that could be delegated? I think fundamentally it goes back to the quip about, you know, elephants in mouse holes, meaning you can't actually hide mice in mouse holes, that's sort of okay, but that you cannot hide elephants in mouse holes, that once it gets sufficiently large. But again, I think more than that from a policy perspective, if you have this concept of Chevron, and I understand there's a broader debate about Chevron, but when you have Chevron, there's an incentive structure in Congress for legislators to get together and they pass a bill. And maybe they can't get it exactly the way they want and still pass it, but they can get it to sort of what I said earlier, between the 40s. Okay, we generally agree that the outcome should be somewhere in here, and we're delegating authority to an agency to figure it out from there. And again, you can make arguments as to why that is a bad thing, but that creates a dynamic that is the opposite of what happens in the absence of major questions doctrine. What happens in the absence of a major questions doctrine is you have legislatures that are refusing, politicians, refusing to come to the middle because they don't have to. And one of the great examples of that is Title II. So there is a lot of people that agree that we'd be better off if Congress passed a law on Title II or net neutrality, whatever the branding is. And there are bills in Congress, but they all come from the left or from the right with a poison pill. And I'll give one on the left. On the left, there's legislation that says we're going to put not the net neutrality rules themselves in place, but the actual agency decision itself from 2015, 2016, which obviously Congress doesn't have to do because they could just legislate anew. But they're refusing to do that. Why? Because they know there's a safety valve. And that safety valve is they can stake out an extreme position in Congress, not work to the middle towards consensus, because an agency is going to come in and do exactly what it is that they want to do on a 3-2 basis. And so I think, again, putting aside separation of powers, constitutional considerations, there is a policy value in the major questions doctrine of compelling, of forcing, to some extent, elective representatives to do their job. We're not necessarily, it's the other way, it's not forcing them to do it. It is removing a safety valve that is harming our politics. There was an op-ed recently in the Washington Post. And they said, we oppose the FCC's decision a couple years ago to do Title II regulation of the internet, because we thought it was a mistake. The FCC is doing it again now, and we, the Washington Post editorial board, are slightly flipping our position. Why? Because they say the internet is too important to be left unregulated. And so we think it is time for the FCC to move forward with Title II. And that's the problem. When you have this safety valve of the agency doing it, people start saying, this is too important. Someone must do something. An agency must step in. But if we have these ability of the agencies to do it, it takes that off the table for Congress to have solved. This problem probably should be solved permanently, but it's one that Congress can do. But without major questions doctrine, without sort of a hard look at Chevron, we are making it easy for Congress, and there's lots of incentive structures right now for members of Congress to go to their corner and not compromise. So it is constitutional and separation of powers, but I also think it's the right thing that will drive the people's actual elective representatives to the middle to compromise.
Maybe I'll respond to the response. You know, having worked in Congress for 15 years, maybe that's why I think the articles of the Constitution were in order for a reason, but also the history of it says the same thing, that Congress sets the rules. And how difficult is that to do? As I said, made the sausage. Working for the majority leader, our job was basically to get consensus. And it's very interesting to think about how that job works. Basically, a lot of the time, I wasn't worried about so much the policy as it was about getting unanimous consent. This is in the 90s, early 2000s. Always trying to get unanimous consent. When we're in the majority, we're working with the minority to see if we can get agreement on things. If it's not a major issue in the Senate, anybody can amend anything anytime. So you want to get something done, you've got to take as many of these amendments as you can. So it's like open season. If there's something you can't agree on, then you get into a vote, but we want to minimize the number of things that go to a vote. So the job is essentially one of building consensus, and the Senate's designed that way. Constantly sort of sublimating our own policy concerns as the leader to the broader role of the Senate in coming together. And the way you do that is often you got to take off the rough edges. I mean, I don't know how many amendments we kind of said, well, that's really pissing off Senator so-and-so, so we got to take that out. Can we adjust this? That gets Senator XYZ mad. Can't we all just agree on this? Okay, fine. This is back in the days when Congress functioned well. It still functions the same way. The problem is you just don't get to that compromise for a number of reasons as it's been politicized. So the fact that Congress can't write specific statutes is not a new problem. This is a very, I'm old, so I guess it's still a problem going back to me, but I think it goes back further than me, even looking at the, you know, Communications Act of 34. You still have, even in the 19th century and 18th century, difficulty of getting very specific in statutes. So statute by requirement and the design is always going to be a little bit higher level. You talk about written by committee. Well, they have committees, lots of committees. And when you're done with the committee, you got the full body. So you talk about a Frankenstein monster. By the time the statute gets out of there, there's been a lot of hands on it, and it's a consensus document because you also get the president to sign it at the end. So that was a Herculean effort to get, you know, acts of Congress done. And now the courts are saying, well, Congress wasn't specific enough on a major question, so we're not going to let the agencies interpret it. Well, you know, Congress has the ability to go back if they think an agency overstepped its bounds. First of all, traditional statutory construction allows the courts to say this isn't consistent with the statute. And there's no reason they need to change how that's done, whether it's major questions or not. You know, you don't have to give Chevron deference to agencies that depart from the clear statutory intention. But you have to give them some deference to be able to interpret vague statutes in ways that bring their expertise to bear, and not have the court substitute its opinion that this is something Congress has got to go back and do when they know full well Congress is not going to do it. And further, Congress has the ability to go back if it thinks that an agency overstepped or misinterpreted the way that it intended for a law to be executed. They can rewrite the law. It's the same issue. They got to go through that whole consensus process, but they can rewrite it. They even put in place a thing called the Congressional Review Act, which means that in the Senate, it's a privileged motion to basically repeal a regulation, and this was applied to FCC regulations. As a matter of fact, it passed a few times, but ultimately is vetoed by the president on FCC regulations. So there is, on broadcast in particular, going back to, you know, media ownership rules. So I think you could say that, I think that the major questions doctrine is a way of bringing more power to the courts to basically second guess almost what agencies are doing and have them be the final arbiter of what Congress intended rather than the agencies on issues where clearly Congress would expect the agencies to act and have some some discretion.
I'm wondering if you could give us a sense of the textual arguments. How did we get from, you know, 1934 Act about radio to this conversation? And the major questions doctrine will obviously be an interesting and important part of how, you know, whatever cases come out of this unfold. But can you just give as background some of the textual arguments in Title I, Title II? What is it that we're talking about? How did we get from radio to net neutrality?
Give a shot.
It's hard to change those. I mean, we're stuck in this Title I, Title II environment, which I don't think is, it's a problem. The Congress can't act to kind of change that. So basically the courts forced, if they wanted to regulate net neutrality, the agency was not able to do it under Title I, so it's basically forced to go to Title II, which isn't, then they end up forbearing from a lot of requirements of Title II, which they didn't intend. So it's extremely awkward that the fact that Congress hasn't been able to change the fundamental structure since 1934, that the FCC is working under this awkward dynamic.
Right. Well, it's, so with 1934, we've got two things. We've got the radio regulation, then we've got the telephone regulation, right? And the, of course, with radio regulation, that this emerged because radio stations would, with the limited spectrum that could be sent and received, particularly at that time. Obviously, we can operate in more frequencies now. But with the limited spectrum that could be sent and received, on which you could transmit and receive at the time, there was a need for some kind of geographic exclusivity and for some sort of separation by frequency. And so there's a coordinating function that you need to do. That's our radio authority. As far as the telephone stuff, let's remember the United States was the only country in the world that had a private telephone system by 1934. The British had one for a while, then it got nationalized. A lot of other places, it was just built by the post office in the first place. So, so the whole idea of a private telephone system was a compromise between the facts on the ground of the capabilities that AT&T had brought to the market. I want to point out that it was already in the trust-busting era that AT&T was making its first deals with the Justice Department back in 1913, right? So this long predates the New Deal as such. It was much more of a recognition that the Bell system had won the fights among the many early telephone companies to reach a combination of the most customers with the best service, with the sharpest elbows, with sometimes exclusions of other parties from their long lines and technical standards, from supplying the phones themselves, which, let's remember, you didn't used to be able to buy a phone, you had to lease it from the phone company. So, so that's the world where we're coming from, where it was the federal government going, you might say back to the first Roosevelt presidency, never mind the subsequent ones, that was grappling with the question, how are we going to keep a private phone system working when it's an inherently exclusionary natural monopoly? And that's where all of this Title II stuff comes from. The reason that we have the whole concept of a Title I service is that we used to be able to do all kinds of other stuff over the phone. I don't know if anyone ever used Dial a Joke or famously that was Woz's first consumer. Yeah, that was Woz's first consumer product back when he was
all the time. I could do that.
Yeah, well, so what it used to be, if you lived in Berkeley, you could call up Steve Wozniak's phone number that he'd set up specifically with an answering machine that had a different Polish joke every day. So, you know, so that's a Title I service, right? We're not going to say there's a natural monopoly in Polish jokes. In fact, they seem to be quite widely disseminated, but you know, But the point is, if your service is stock quotes, if your service is voicemail, if your service is dial a joke, it makes sense that you're not going to treat that like that's monopoly era AT&T. That's the only place that can run a phone line into people's houses and it controls all the switching stations and that manufactures all the phones and all the switchboards and whatnot through its subsidiaries. So. We find ourselves, as my colleagues have said, with a law that seems rather poorly adapted to the times. If we're going to say that we need to have the Title II framework, then we're really saying that we need to have the system that was set up as an alternative to nationalizing AT&T back when AT&T was the only game in town, and that we're going to apply it to every internet service provider in the country, including the wireless ones that talk to our phones, which is, you know, that puts us, again, in an even more convoluted situation. Because if we're going to say that you can't discriminate and that there's de facto unlimited settlement-free peering, in other words, the phone has to take whatever gets pushed down to it, obviously we want that in a certain sense. We don't want your phone picking and choosing what websites you're allowed to go to. But it also means that the federal government, which constrains the supply of spectrum, is providing the spectral equivalent of an unfunded mandate. Right? They're saying your phone has to take whatever gets pushed down, but we won't provide the spectral resources to do it. It's a very tough question. And I love it when Congress answers these sorts of questions for us, because you know, that resolves a good degree of ambiguity. As for how do we deal with the statutory language when the social facts have changed this time and the other time and the third time, let's think back to the 96 Act, which, as Commissioner Clyburn pointed out, was the last time that Congress fully wrapped its arms around the question. At that time, your internet service and your phone company were two different things, more or less. You had dial-up internet service, right? A few fortunate people had T1 lines or DSL, but it was mainly dial-up internet. And there was a natural disconnect between your ISP. ISP used to mean the person who was the company that was connecting you to your internet service via your phone line, rather than the company that provided the line. There was a natural split between that, and so we wound up in this area where it seemed obvious that the phone line was still a natural monopoly, but that your internet service provider was a specialized service that you would get over it. So in other words, a Title I service. And again, with the consolidation of those two things, we've been striving to unpick this thing. Brand X came up, well, that's where Justice Scalia raised his famous pizzeria argument against Title I treatment in favor of Title II treatment. He's saying, what, can you really separate these? If you're getting the line and the service from the same place, isn't this like the pizzeria saying, we don't offer delivery, all we do is bake a pizza and send it to your house, two different services. Right? But that shows the difficulty of grappling with this. Justice Thomas has repudiated his position in Brand X, but it remains good law. So, but good law enough to base further decisions on? I say it's a very muddled situation.
Well, I'll just add, this is why when people talk about Republican commissioners, they say, are you referring to the smart one or the other one? That's an example of why people make that distinction right there. But look, on Brand X, too, I think you know, we have to recognize there's been a sea change with West Virginia versus EPA. What Brand X said was, exactly we think right. It is ambiguous as to whether the internet should be treated as a Title I or Title II service. And now what we know after West Virginia versus EPA is that is a decision that cuts against Title II, meaning the presence of mere ambiguity is no longer enough post West Virginia versus EPA to impose Title II classification. So it cuts our way. In fact, you know, Don Verrilli, the former Obama Solicitor General, filed a paper at the FCC saying exactly that, which is today, post West Virginia versus EPA, to turn the internet from a Title I to a Title II service would run afoul of West Virginia versus EPA.
We have a few minutes left, so let me open up the floor to see if there's any questions from the audience. Yeah. I think that's probably better, yeah, for people who are watching online.
No pressure. There's like eight people watching online, so don't mess this up.
Hi, my name is Graciela Pastor. I'm at Jones Day. I have two questions, actually. The Digital Equity Initiative that you were discussing in the beginning, Commissioner Carr, was probably not foreseen by Congress in passing the infrastructure bill. So do you or do the other commissioners foresee agencies like the FCC or other agencies continue to needing to have their regulations shut down by the Supreme Court and the major questions doctrine? Or do you think that they're now going to reformulate? Because what it sounds like is that they're going to maybe keep pushing from what you've all discussed. And it's very expensive to overturn every administrative agency decision. So it's kind of two questions in one, but or that's just the first question. But
yeah, thanks. I mean, my view is yes. You know, we are going to vote next Wednesday. It's going to pass this digital equity provision. As you noted, it was based on one page of law of the 1,000-plus page of the 2021 Infrastructure Act. It did not contemplate, let alone authorize us to adopt this just sweeping, intrusive set of rules. And I think this is going to be another instance where West Virginia versus EPA and the harder look that courts are giving at Chevron is going to result in an overturning of the FCC's decision. Again, it's going to be a waste of resources to get there, but thankfully for you, being at Jones Day, you can benefit from some of the waste of resources on the way there.
Yeah, I also have a second question, which is, you know, as current and former commissioners at an administrative agency, can you contemplate a legislative solution to limiting agencies from broadening their powers outside of the courts, or is it only the courts? Because, as I just said, it is extremely expensive to continue to have to overturn these agency decisions, and especially when they've gone so off the cuff or they've gone in such a different direction. So is there another solution to limiting their powers?
I mean, they could be more specific in their
in there, I mean, Congress can be more specific. I think that's the goal of some of those who are pushing the major questions doctrine, is for Congress to specify exactly what they mean in terms of what the level of delegation is and what agencies should do. But the way Congress is moving since my days there, and I think everybody sees this, is that it's more difficult to do that, not less, given the polarization and the way that Congress is functioning. It used to function much more on a bipartisan basis, where that was also difficult. But now, without, unless you get one party in control of both and 60 votes in the Senate, which only happened for a very brief period under Obama, and then we haven't seen it since, there is a very great difficulty in getting that done.
Let's see. No, I'll go ahead and defer to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we have time for one more.
Ben Slifka, visiting from Seattle, retired monopolist. I remember the days of 110 baud dial-up modems, but I took a Starlink antenna up to 74 degrees north in Canada in July. I got 140 megabits a second down and 40 megabits a second up. How does the, and I think the, you'll see the prevalence of satellite internet service increase dramatically and the prices will drop dramatically. How would that change the discussions you've had?
So I should defer to you given the Canadian nature of the question, and Simon is from Canada. Well, one thing that's interesting is, and this sort of goes to some of the backwards nature of regulation, is a lot of people at the FCC, not myself, will look at the fact that, you know, you have that high quality service from a low Earth orbit satellite, Starlink, and some of us will say it's great, and some of people will say, well, we're actually gonna treat that as if it's 0 megabits per second over 0 megabits per second, because we have a policy preference to build fiber to 100% of the location. So when you hear people talk about the digital divide in this country, there's all sorts of juicing the numbers. You hear this number about 15 or 16 million people, but what you're actually seeing with that is that's some people that don't have a fixed, wired internet connection. But if you look at people that have access to all sorts of different technologies to get what they want, which is just, I want my phone to work, the number is much lower. So I think we should be looking to those types of technologies to complement what we have, but there's a policy override that's getting in the way. I don't know if you wanted to add.
You know, I was just about diving forward to eat my microphone when you came, because you know, I think the very first thing I ever said at the very first speech I ever gave after taking office at the Free State Foundation for Randy May was that we have a wide diversity of mechanisms for delivery at the last mile at this point. And that really undermines the rationale for Title II, since the whole point of a natural monopoly is that it actually is an exclusionary monopoly. If you can get fixed wireless service that's just as fast as wired, and if you can get satellite on top of that, then you don't just have three different services, you have three different mediums of service with potential for multiple providers in each one of those. And I think under those circumstances, it would have been very hard to justify Title II in the first place, and it wouldn't have been justified, and there wouldn't have been a rivalry between, for example, the Bell system and the other telephone systems. If they all could have been delivered wirelessly using a small number of facilities to cover a wide area, then there never would have been telephone monopolies in the first place, and we'd be looking at a very different history of telecommunications law. Now what we have, if anything, is a wide diversity of physical media of connection leading up to a relatively small number of upstream services, which, you know, are arguably the ones where we should start asking questions about common carriage in this day and age. So it's a very, very different situation from what we saw before. Personally, I would feel much less upset if I get fired by my wireline ISP to my house, because then I would turn to my hotspot on my phone, I'd be back online in 3 or 4 seconds, you know. I feel a lot less upset about that than being barred from one of the big 4 or 5 big tech ecosystems. Yeah. Because on my ISP fires me, I can get a new one. Well, I pick up my phone and I have a new one. I drive down to Starbucks and I have a new one. You know, it's really not a big deal compared to what it used to be if, for example, AT&T were to ban you from its system. But if you get demonetized from a site where you've got millions of followers, or what you've based your living on, and that where you've expected that the terms of service were going to sustain you, and then all of a sudden you get fired off of that, that's a very, very different world. So if we were writing the regs under contemporary circumstances, there's no way we'd wind up here. There's no way Congress would have brought us here. And increasingly, we're clinging to this last mile, not because we're like the drunk looking for his keys. You know, everyone knows this joke. The drunk looking for his keys under the street light, right? And he's like, I lost my keys in the alley. Well, why are you looking over here? Because the light is better here. You know, we've got a clear regulatory predicate for reaching the last mile ISPs, because we always did, because that was how monopoly AT&T worked. If that isn't relevant anymore, then there's the question, if we do have a predicate to act, but it's no longer wise to act, to what degree should we still be acting?
Yeah, having been there in the early days, I completely concur with your point, and your point is valid on the capacity issue. I mean, going back to the early days, 2003, the concern was there wasn't adequate capacity from ISPs, so they needed to be regulated in order to ensure that they didn't throttle in order to advance their own services, perhaps, or advance their own content to the degree that they acquired it. Right now, there's so much capacity and so much competition that those arguments are really moot, as you pointed out, and I think that's a good example. Even satellite is an option. If Verizon, my Fios, was discriminating, I'd go to Comcast in my neighborhood. Now, some places have less options, but ultimately, they do have SpaceX. I mean, there generally is competition for basic broadband. The speeds are so much faster. There's really no incentive or ability for carriers to discriminate in the way that was originally the concern that prompted early calls for going to Title II. So I'd really concur with you on that.
And two things I will add to that is there is not evenness. So the absolutes that I think I'm hearing here don't necessarily exist in every hamlet in this nation when it comes to opportunities at my doorstep. And I continue to bring up that there are a lot of economic incentives, economic capacity that we see flowing through the states from the government. Traditional and legacy incentives to do some of the harms that you hear people like me speaking about, they're not there today. My issue is always, do we have the proper backstops in terms of ensuring and protecting those when tomorrow comes and the nature of all of this and the conversations we're having and the money and all of the incentives are no longer there? Will these companies and will some of your clients act in the same manner? And if they don't, what type of backstop, regulatory or otherwise, would they have if individuals are harmed?
Okay, well, we're out of time, but thank you so much to our panelists for this really great discussion. One quick announcement.